plane you're seeing now is the C-123, which transported in the big limousine, the famous bubble top limousine, which the President and First Lady will ride in. Depending on the weather, if it's nice weather, no rain, top would be down. So President waves goodbye, waits for his wife, and back they go to the car. Governor Connally standing in the car beaming. It'll turn on Houston Street to Elm under the Triple Underpass.
He was shot by an assassin at the intersection of Elm and Houston Streets just as he was going into the underpass.
The President of the United States has been the victim of an assassination.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago.
And this is something you do read in history books and just never want to believe that can happen when you're living.
There is no more news here tonight and really no more to say except that what has happened today has been just too much, too ugly, and too fast.
Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
We hope you like us when we're angry. I'm Dean Karyanis.
And I'm Owen Mugen. Welcome back to the Angry History Podcast.
We're going to give you a brief overview today of the 50 years since John F. Kennedy was shot. Of course, a ton has been said, but as you probably know if you've been listening to our past podcasts and our 70,000 downloads now show that you have, and we thank you, you know that we still have more to say.
We do, and by brief, Dean means probably not really brief. At all, because we're just looking at our notes here, and we've got a lot of ground to cover today. It is insane that it's been 50 years. Dean and I weren't born yet, but his shadow, his face was ever present, especially with us growing up. You want to think about the triptychs, almost like religious iconography you'd have in many households. You'd have Pope John the 23rd, Martin Luther King Jr., and John F. Kennedy, and that would be sort of the triple play of devotion, certainly for with the Pope and John F. Kennedy. For Catholics, President Kennedy was the only Catholic president of the United States.
Now, why was he in Dallas? We all know where it happened, and we're going to talk about the city and talk about the cauldron that was kind of boiling there at the time in 1963. But why was he there?
Well, it was November of 63. He was just beginning to really start to think about getting his reelection up and running. Of course, you know, as we realize now, it's a never-ending process. You know, you go from one election, one general election, to the midterms, to the next general election, to the midterm, over and over and over again. It just doesn't stop. But back then, there was actually some breathing room. You know, as with everything else, the noise machine simply was not as loud. But the president was thinking about what he needed to do, and there were some stress fractures in the Democratic Party in Texas at the time. And part of the mentality that brought him down there was to try to sort of kill some of this infighting because he felt that it jeopardizes chances of carrying the state. And he hoped that the trip would begin to bring the party together just a little bit.
And there was kind of a, I don't know what you would call it, there was almost kind of a sweet aspect and a nostalgic aspect to this fundraiser he was going to that night. Speaking of not having the permanent campaign yet established, he was going to a fundraiser dinner, and what was the amount that he was charging people? It was ridiculously low.
Well, it was $100 a plate, and that's, I think, well, we did the math, $716 in 2013 bucks, more or less. I mean, think about it.
Yeah, I mean, you can't get anywhere near a president for dinner or to have a coffee or ever, much less a picture and shake the guy's hand for anything that's not in the $10,000, $15,000.
No, but it's so nice now that the president is so close to us with every email we write and every phone conversation we have. He's there. Hi, Mr. President. But it was a different time, an entirely different time. But let's start to think a little bit about before all the things with which we're overly familiar, which are the Cronkite sound bites and the Dan Rather and the Eddie Barker, things that we're all pretty familiar with. I mean, this was the first assassination in the media age. And we'll talk a bit about our previously martyred presidents. The one before President Kennedy was President McKinley, and that was 62 years before. So when this happened, it not only happened on television, not only happened on the radio, but it was relatively fresh for everyone who was alive. You had some old timers who were still around in the early 60s who were around for President McKinley, but this was unlike anything that had ever happened before. So the president was due to arrive at Love Field in Dallas on Friday, November 22nd, 1963, at 11:40 a.m. Central Standard Time. And the motorcade was scheduled to enter Dealey Plaza at 12:10, and a steak luncheon with a lot of Dallas big shots was due to start at 12:15. Now, the way the coverage was handled then, it's sort of what we refer to nowadays as pool coverage. Like, say, for example, Fox News will get to cover the, president's arrival at A, B, or C. And then you'll have NBC, you know, handle the coverage at something else later, and everyone shares the coverage. And that was the case this morning. Bob Walker, who we're about to hear a lot of, he was WFAA TV 8, that was ABC, and they provided live coverage of the arrival at Love Field. KRLD-TV, which is a CBS channel, they had Eddie Barker, who we'll hear, and he was set up at the trademark for the luncheon speech that never came. An independent channel, 11, KTVT, that covered the president's breakfast speech in Fort Worth earlier in the day. And then also they had for the arrival on radio was Joe Long of KLIF 1190. Now this is a thing that this whole section that we're about to go into, where we're hearing a lot about Bob Walker, he's vamping for us from Love Field. You work in news like Dean and I have, and you have days when you go into the office and you write up your rundown and you produce what your show is going to be. And then you have an event, something that happens, breaking news, that makes you throw all that out the window. And I remember being in the control room for a Columbine, and it was just another day, and we had a show planned, until you don't. It all goes away, the adrenaline takes over, and you begin to go wall to wall and roll with the punches. But I find myself, like on days like Columbine, thinking back to the show that could have been, or Columbia, for that matter, the destruction of the shuttle Columbia, of the show that could have been. Because you know what? When you're dealing with something as miserable as Columbine or as sad as Columbia, you kind of want to go back, and you kind of wish you had the boring day that you had planned. It's also the point in time where you're at your most responsible as a journalist. But here we go right back. We're going to go right back to the very beginning. We're going to go to the moments when Bob Walker begins his vamping, and as we're waiting for the president and his party to arrive in Dallas. Here we go.
When the president appeared on the parking lot earlier today, that, by the way, the plane you're seeing now is the C-123, which transported in the big limousine, the famous bubble-top limousine, which the president and first lady will ride in. However, that limousine now is down in front of the welcoming ramp, and yes, I can see it from here, and it does not have the top up, so our information from some of the Secret Service men earlier was correct that depending on the weather, if it's nice weather, no rain, top would be down. So evidently, for all of you people who will see the parade downtown, you'll see a glimpse of the President and First Lady in the flesh rather than through the bubble top glass on the outside.
Now, when you hear all of that, you have to just want to scream back. Secret Service should not be telling everybody where he's going, what the car is going to, and put up the bubble top. And this was it just, of course, we all connect the dots, to use the phrase we've heard ad infinitum the last dozen years afterwards. But these were things that they could have and should have implemented, you would think, when you've had, after President McKinley was shot is when the Secret Service took over. And even they should have known. You have this guy approaching the president with his hand wrapped in a bandage. You know, the first rule is you have all the hands visible.
Right.
You know, nobody with their hands concealed or in a pocket or anything. And you've had them try to kill a few presidents since then, before 1962. And you just wish, you know, nobody's perfect. But you wish this would have happened, especially since Kennedy also narrowly escaped an assassination attempt when he was president-elect, which we'll talk about a little bit later.
Yep. And as Walker continues, you know, it's just more of this tragic sort of ordinary talk. None of this is going to matter inside of an hour.
The first lady was not there. The president told him that she was upstairs prettying up and said it took her longer to get pretty than it did him, and the crowd loved that. She was wearing this morning a suit of some sort of nubby material, pillbox hat and all. The president also said this morning in Fort Worth that It was the same, it's been the same in Texas as it was in Paris. It seems a lot of people are as much interested in seeing Jackie as him. In fact, he said today in Fort Worth, nobody seems to care what Lyndon and I are wearing. And of course, that drew a big laugh and a hand, but the people in Fort Worth did something about it because they presented a pair of boots and a hat, big Texas-style hat to the president and a pair of boots to Mrs. Kennedy. So they have at least going to have some Texas clothes to take home and wear around the White House.
And that just gets me because, of course, they won't. You know, you always hear about all the great things, the gifts the presidents receive. And isn't, you know this better than I, Dean, and they're not really not allowed to keep any of it, right? Or only some of it?
Well, back then, I think they were allowed to hold on to some of it, but it was, and probably, like, you know, Eisenhower, of course, just before Kennedy, actually was able to, you know, go to golf courses and this and that. I don't think they had the laws that they have today. I mean, the guy's only raising a few a few hundred bucks there to go to dinner. And which, one thing is, you know, it is quaint and it is nice and more democratic, and I'm sure Thomas Jefferson would have loved it. But also, because this is the very beginning of TV, remember, there's only so much TV to buy. And if you look, even if you look back at those older campaigns, it was a while before they surpassed all the money that McKinley spent in his campaign, believe it or not, in 1990.
Now the loading ramp being moved up. The doors of the Big Bird swing open. Inside the door, the seal of the President of the United States. Mrs. Cabell approaching with some red roses. Military delegation coming off first. There's Mrs. Kennedy, and the crowd yells, and the President of the United States. And I can see his suntan all the way from here.
I can see his suntan from all the way up here.
Yeah.
To me, as I was listening to that, I thought maybe there's other reasons why this is just so strikes us as an assassination in a way that maybe McKinley and even Lincoln doesn't. And Garfield, Lincoln, he finished the war. I mean, he died at kind of a gun of a good time, historically speaking, before all the messy Reconstruction work started.
Yeah.
McKinley, even on his deathbed, he said, it's God's will, not ours. You know, he had served in the Civil War. He'd reunited the nation after the Civil War in his presidency. He was older. He'd done so much and accomplished so much. He didn't want to die. But, you know, he had done that already. Garfield, unfortunately, was just a few months in when he was shot. And there was just, you know, this crazy guy. So, I mean, they're all, I guess, unbalanced to some extent. But here with Kennedy, it really is that youth in the sense of there are so many what might have been that I don't think academics ask it about Lincoln and you know, maybe about McKinley and maybe about, you know. But with Kennedy, it's just to see somebody who really was so early. I mean, 1,000 days. I think that maybe that's part of the reason why. I'm sure it's not terribly original on my part, but
no.
It was just that idea of the suntan, just, you know.
Well, it didn't. He was, you know, he was such a modern guy in so many ways now. I mean, he was the first president to get rid of the hat, you know, and he was so youthful, and his wife was so youthful and beautiful, and he had these two beautiful kids, and there were a lot of what the president represented to a lot of people was this notion of hope, and goodness, didn't we just go right down into the hellmouth throughout the rest of that decade
now,
once he was killed.
With people, the president and his wife are right up on the fence. The press is standing up high, getting a lot of shots of this. He's done as he has done in several places. He's broken away from his planned...
Now here he's going impromptu to shake hands with the crowd. And the receiving line was actually a tradition that survived, I believe, all the way up to President Clinton. And that was, you know, guys... I mean, gosh, Kennedy was his role model, right? And to an extent, the presidents who are these sort of, you know... thrive on the crowd, and not all politicians, not all presidents do. He wanted to get out there and be with people and press the flesh. And I believe it was finally his wife, after, you know, one of these attempts they get all the time, they said, you know, we're going to close down Pennsylvania Avenue, and, you know, you just can't do the receiving line anymore. And that was something maybe some presidents would welcome. They're not really people.
Right.
But, you know, President Clinton wasn't too happy to have to give up doing that receiving line. And he does it all the time now, even when we see him in New York.
Right. I mean, because that guy, it's like some kind of, it's like chemistry. You put that man in a room with, you know, with the so-called regular folk, and, you know, it's just everything lights up. You know, some guys are awesome at it, like President Clinton was. Here we are. We're getting closer to leaving Love Field. A bit more now about the limo and the governor waiting for the president in it.
President still moving over towards some phone booths that were set up for the press. The people surging up toward that fence. But there is a fence, and the president waves goodbye, waits for his wife. And back they go to the car. Governor Connally standing in the car, beaming. Governor Connally with a big 10-gallon hat on. Mrs. Kennedy stepping in the car first. Now the president. They both in the back seat now. Now the motorcade will very shortly start to move out. Sheriff Bill Decker, Dallas County Sheriff, driving his own car, personally escorting it with the Chief of Police, the presidential car moving out, the President and First Lady. Big, beautiful Lincoln.
And he's in a Lincoln.
Ugh, I know. But didn't he also have a secretary name? Well, we'll get to all those later. And I know you can't wait for that. Thinking about this and hearing this soundbite, President Kennedy will never leave that car under his own power again. It's another last. He's taken his last steps. Time is running out.
So close to that underpass. I mean, another, what, 30 feet? And he's safe.
Yep, and this sort of speaks to that point. I mean, we're pretty sure Oswald was already in place. He didn't learn anything new off the radio, but we'll give a listen to this.
So the party now is leaving Dallas Love Field. The three big White House press charter buses behind us getting ready to pull out. And, of course, as we say, thousands will be on hand for that motorcade now, which will be downtown Dallas, down Cedar Springs, to Harwood. And on Harwood, it'll turn on Main, from which point it'll go all the way down to the courthouse area, which is the end of Main. It'll turn on Houston Street to Elm under the Triple Underpass, out to the Mart, where the president talks at approximately 1 o'clock, which will also be carried live right here on most of these channels. And then we'll be back here again, of course, as we told you, at about 2:15 for the president's departure.
You have to feel for the Secret Service guys that are there. I mean,
yeah.
Part of this is, you know, most people probably know today, you know, the term embargoed. They may not have been supposed to say this stuff, but, and they may have just known the route, and it may have been very much publicized before, and they were just kind of vamping there, you know. You don't want dead air, you're talking.
No.
But also, I mean, these guys really have a hard job. They have to be right all the time, and, you know, the assassin only has to be right once, as the IRA said when they tried to blow up Margaret Thatcher. You have to be lucky all the time. So it's easy to blame those guys, I think, and say they did a horrible job. I mean, the head of the Secret Service, after that near car bomb that almost killed Kennedy when he was president-elect, said he never should have gotten that close. But I was at a wedding once, and they'd hired some of these former White House security guys, you know, former Secret Service guys, there to just do this wedding. And those guys are huge. They're no nonsense. They're really smart. I mean, we can have some real confidence in them, but there's always these things that can still happen no matter how much you prepare. And we learned a lot from the Kennedy assassination. Unfortunately, he had to be dead before we learned it.
Absolutely. I remember firsthand dealing with the Secret Service years ago, not too long after the beginning of the Iraq War in 2003, Vice President Cheney came to visit us at work. And goodness gracious, I mean, we show up early and you can be sure that the Secret Service, well, they were there the day before, and they were vetting the whole place and checking everything out, and it's like, you ever remember that feeling when, I don't know, maybe I just have a guilty conscience about certain things, but, you know, you walk out of a bookstore and you hope the thing didn't go off. You know you didn't steal anything, but it's like you hope that thing doesn't go off. Like, you know, somebody maybe stuffed a choose-your-own-adventure into the back of my jeans, and I wasn't even looking. But it was that sort of feeling. It's like, man, you were definitely scrutinized, and with good reason.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, they're big guys, and our friend Mojo, who we're making a minor celebrity, I guess, here, because we keep bringing up his little history. But he said
he doesn't really exist.
Yeah.
He is Dean and I when we were together physically. It's just, no, that doesn't sound good.
We had that event, and there was a restaurant one time, also a vice president was there. And Keith said he walked by these Secret Service guys on the way to the bathroom, and he said, man, like not even a flinch, not even a second look at me. Just like, oh, you're no threat at all. And like, just looks away. It's like, I'm used to at least a little bit of a, you know, maybe reach for the gun, something.
Right,
like,
exactly.
These guys, you know, ripping phone books in half with their bare hands. And, you know,
this is Keith, who has like, you know, half of his skeleton is like, you know, adamantium. He's like Wolverine. You'd think he'd set off every alarm in the world, but
No.
This is our last bit from Bob Walker and from Love Field. 50 years ago, where Walker talks about plans that will never happen.
And these three big jets will be here on the ground at Love Field until about 2:15 this afternoon, at which time the president will take off and go to Austin. He isn't through either. His Texas tour is by no means over, because he has a busy day scheduled for Austin. They're due to land down there at Bergstrom Air Force Base at about 3:15 this afternoon. There's going to be a motorcade there, 7 miles from Bergstrom down to downtown Austin. They're going to drive 9 blocks down Congress Avenue, stop at the Commodore Perry Hotel in Austin, which will be headquarters for their visit there. At 4:15 this afternoon, a reception at the hotel for members of the State Democratic Executive Committee. The president will make a brief appearance there. At 6:15 this evening, the president with Mrs. Kennedy will attend another reception at the governor's mansion, attended by members of the state legislature and some statewide elected officials. The president's final official appearance will be tonight at 7:30 in Austin at that $100 a plate Texas welcome dinner in honor of the president and vice president. Eugene Locke of Dallas, who is state Democratic Party chairman, will be the master of ceremonies, with Mrs. Kennedy, Mrs. Johnson, Governor, and Mrs. Connolly among those at the head table. This will be held at the Austin Municipal Auditorium. The president will then go to the LBJ Ranch, where he and Mrs. Kennedy will spend the night. Then they will leave sometime about, I think midday tomorrow is the latest word we have, at what time they will leave and fly back. The president's weekend, however, will not be over, because word from Washington indicates that the president will meet with Henry Cabot Lodge, who has just returned from South Vietnam, a special presidential mission and advisor out there. And there will be some very lengthy discussions this weekend at the president's Maryland retreat concerning the recognition of a new government in South Vietnam. The possibility and the timing of that recognition will be discussed. So that's the life of a president, however. And so all is not just pleasure this weekend, because, as we said, the president gets back to business tomorrow evening when he gets back to Washington.
It's all completely normal up to this point. I mean, this is just them filling their day as reporters, trying to do their job, being they're pioneers in this field. So they're making it up as they go along, even more than somebody would today. And nobody knows that two shots are going to come out of the air and just change everything, really.
No, I mean, the steak luncheon, the food is being prepared already, the staff is there, maybe, you know, some guests are certainly there already, you know, everything, it's go time. And America's about to change, and let's hear it how so many of us did. Well, not us, I mean, goodness, we all listened to it obsessively later on. You know, growing up, we had all these crazy... This assassination was fetishized, because there was so many elements. I mean, we had all the footage, we had all the radio stuff, we had the terrible images of the president grabbing his throat, you know, right after he emerges from that sign. All the terrible things that for years have fueled our history and our pop culture. And let's give a listen to The Voice, to Walter Cronkite.
This is Walter
Cronkite in our newsroom. There has been an attempt, as perhaps you know now, on the life of President Kennedy. He was wounded in an automobile driving from Dallas Airport into downtown Dallas, along with Governor Connally of Texas. They've been taken to Parkland Hospital there, where their condition is as yet unknown. We have not been told their condition. At Dallas, in the downtown hotel room, a group had been gathered to hear President Kennedy when he was waiting his arrival. Let's switch down there now, where Eddie Barker of KRLD is on the air.
As you can imagine, there are many stories that are coming in now as to the actual condition of the president. One is that he is dead. This cannot be confirmed. Another is that Governor Connally is in the operating room. This we have not confirmed. The president was whisked from the scene of the attempted assassination, or assassination depending upon his condition, of course, at this hour, by bus to Parkland Hospital. And the president undoubtedly is in the emergency room at that hospital, which would be on the first floor of Parkland. No word as yet. We are awaiting something more official. It is, of course, difficult, certainly, to go on scanty reports.
This is Walter Cronkite back at the CBS newsroom in New York. We have just been advised from Dallas that blood transfusions are being given to President Kennedy. Let us recall for you now what has transpired in this.
KRLD is reporting they've been told by somebody in the hospital the president is dead. Only a rumor, but they've been told that KRLD is saying.
Well, that's a repeat of something that you heard reported to you directly a moment ago from KRLD television in Dallas, and that is the rumor that has reached them at the hotel that the president is dead. Totally unconfirmed, apparently, as yet. However, let's go back to KRLD in Dallas.
Operating room, we do not know what his condition is, but the report is that the president is dead. This is not confirmed. This is something that word just came to us a minute ago. The word we have is that President Kennedy is dead. This we do not know for a fact. The word we have is that he is dead. That he was shot by an assassin at the intersection of Elm and Houston Streets just as he was going into the underpass. The word we have is from a doctor on the staff of Parkland Hospital, who says that it is true. He was in tears when he told me just a moment ago. This is still not officially confirmed, but as I say, the source would normally be a good one.
That was Eddie Barker at our affiliate KRLD in Dallas, Texas, speaking from the room where President Kennedy had been scheduled to make an address to three Dallas organizations. But an assassin's bullets cut him down on the way to that meeting from the airport. It was just an hour ago that the incident took place. We have just learned, however, that Father Huber, one of the two priests called into the room, has administered the last sacrament of the church to President Kennedy. Regarding the probable assassin, the sheriff's officers have taken a young man into custody at the scene, a man 25 years old. We just have a report from our correspondent Dan, rather in Dallas, that he has confirmed that President Kennedy is dead. There is still no official confirmation of this, however. It's a report from our correspondent Dan Rather in Dallas, Texas. We're now going into that Dallas luncheon the president had planned to address. Let's go back. Prayers, we understand, are underway.
That we may reveal that calm that shall be sweet into thee.
Vice President Lyndon Johnson has not been seen in the corridors of the Parkland Hospital. He was said to perhaps have been slightly wounded in the arm. Mrs. Lyndon Johnson says that the vice president, though, is fine. Throughout the streets of Dallas, the Dallas police had been augmented by some 400 policemen called in on their day off because there were some fears and concerns in Dallas that there might be demonstrations, at least, that could embarrass the president, because it was only on October the 24th that our ambassador to the United Nations, Adlai Stevenson, was assaulted in Dallas, leaving a dinner meeting there. from Dallas, Texas, the Flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago. Vice President Lyndon Johnson has left the hospital in Dallas, but we do not know to where he has proceeded. Presumably, he will be taking the oath of office shortly and become the 36th President of the United States.
I would say prior to 9/11, this day and all of its attendant media coverage was probably the biggest story ever captured. Certainly the biggest surprise story ever captured. And it still gets me to watch the footage of Cronkite, you know, a man who is so professional and so on his game, to show us the humanity of the day through his tears. It's terrible. It's still so upsetting to listen to. I mean, when you kill a president, you do so much more than kill the man. You know, you do serious damage to the nation, to the fabric and the soul. All right, let's go right to this next bit from Dan Rather.
President Kennedy could be seen to put his right hand up to the side of his head to either brush back his hair or perhaps rub his eyebrow. President Kennedy was sitting on the same side of the car as the building from which the shot came. Mrs. Kennedy was by his side. In the jump seat in front of them, Mrs. Connolly and Governor Connolly. Governor Connolly on the same side of the car as the president, and in the front seat, two Secret Service men. Just as the president put that right hand up to the side of his head, you could see him lurch forward. The first shot had hit him. Mrs. Kennedy was looking in another direction and apparently didn't see or sense that first shot or didn't hear it. But Governor Connolly, in the seat in front, appeared to have heard it, or at least sensed that something was wrong. The governor's coat was open. He reached back in this fashion, exposing his white shirt front at the assassin's window. He reached back as if to offer aid or ask the president something. At that moment, a shot clearly hit the governor in the front, and he fell back in the seat. Mrs. Connolly immediately threw herself over him in a protective position. In the next instant, with this time Mrs. Kennedy apparently looking on, a second shot, the third total shot, hit the president's head. His head could be seen to move violently forward. And Mrs. Kennedy stood up immediately. The president leaned over her way. It appeared that he might have brushed her legs. Mrs. Kennedy then literally went on the top of the trunk of the Lincoln car, put practically her whole body on the trunk. It appeared she might have been on her all fours there, reaching out for the Secret Service man, the lone Secret Service man who was riding on the bumper of the car, the back bumper on Mrs. Kennedy's side. The Secret Service man leaned forward and put his hands on Mrs. Kennedy's shoulder to push her back into the car. She was in some danger, it appeared, of rolling off or falling off. When we described this before, there was some question about what we meant by Mrs. Kennedy being on the trunk of the car. Only she knows, but it appeared that she was trying desperately to get the Secret Service man's attention, or perhaps to help pull him into the car. The car never stopped. It never paused. In the front seat, a Secret Service man was on the telephone. The car picked up speed and disappeared beneath an underpass.
Now, Dan Rather is somebody that we did grow up watching, and this is really where he got his start in this sort of, you know, this is his backyard, right? He's lived in Dallas. He's, you know, and he's still around today. He didn't have the end, I'm sure, that he would have wanted with the Bush National Guard documents, but Owen and I were both talking while this was playing, and we were saying, he's a happy guy and a nice guy if you meet him in person. And we were just mentioning, oh, yeah, we've run into him on separate occasions. And we have another friend, actually, Mojo's brother, who who ran into him in an elevator. It was the same thing. And they, you know, he was a young guy at that point. And he just was asking him all about his career in the media and just the nicest guy. He was very nice to the mothers of one of the hosts that I work with who grew up watching him and Dan Rather. And he's just a very nice guy. And it's too bad that he came to that end because, you know, he didn't. You know that he didn't do that on purpose, and I was thinking about him today. Actually, I was looking up at BlackRock, and he didn't. He didn't intend that. And I think a lot of the anchors today would simply go with whatever story and then just move on. In fact, we don't really have anchors anymore, do we?
So. No, not in the same sense. I mean, you look at half the guys who were ripping him to shreds post facto, and they frankly couldn't carry Dan Rather's jock for all the mileage and great reporting that this guy really did do. I met him a couple of years ago, right after he lost his job. I met him at something called the TCAs, which is a Television Critics Association, and it's a sort of, hey, let's get together and, you know, drink and go to a couple panels and then drink some more and write snarky articles about TV. And he was there for some news reason. He was giving a talk, and all of a sudden I turned down the hallway in this hotel in Pasadena, California, out here, and there's Dan Rather walking by himself with his jacket, you know, his travel bag over his arm, and we make eye contact, and I had to stop him. I said, hey, Mr. Rather, I just wanted to introduce myself. I don't get starstruck for anyone, but when you have someone who's, you know, between JFK and the Democratic Convention in Chicago, all this insane, great coverage, and the weirdness of What's the Frequency, Kenneth, when he was attacked in the streets, and I told him I was sorry to see things end for him the way they did, and the man I just met him, he welled up, and gave me a total shoulder man hug, you know. And he said, thanks a lot for saying it. He said, you know, I just hearing that now hit me the right way. So I don't know. It was just an interesting encounter with someone who, despite this terrible misstep with the National Guard stuff, was a great reporter and a great anchor.
Yeah, I don't think he, you know, we're going to talk a little bit later about that grammar school thing going back to the JFK time.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think he really did build a career, and that's what I meant. I mean, not to insult anybody today, but you had three anchors, and that was it back then. And if you were one of them, you know, there was a responsibility, and you could like one more than the other, but, you know, there was a lot to be put in there, and I don't think he was going to risk that over something that was so small. I mean, sometimes you want something to be true, maybe. You want to break the big story.
Sure.
But let's face it, he broke this when he was really young, all this JFK stuff. Or, you know, he's on the scene, you know, he broke some, he heard some of it, he's repeating it. You know, you want to live that again, and you want to do it. And, you know, anybody can fall prey to that. And I think that was the case. And, you know, it would be a little easier to laugh at him if you didn't meet him and have him say, oh, hey, how you doing?
Right. You know? Right. Well, that generally, I mean, that's sort of what happens with everything. I mean, and this speaks to some of the gripes you and I have about where we are with internet culture and all that, where, you know, you do things or you treat someone or look at someone differently without the benefit of meeting them because you're never going to meet people. And so you may as well, you know, mouth off and shoot off in their general direction. But it's nothing, no better equalizer than actually meeting someone and looking them right in the eye.
Yeah. All right, so back to the Kennedy assassination.
Yep.
We have another bite from NBC News.
If we can, we will try to clear up this arrest which is taking place in Dallas. The police department has arrested a man, but in connection with the shooting of a Dallas policeman, the fatal shooting of a Dallas policeman, the man was arrested in a theater in the Oak Cliff section of Dallas. He had a pistol at the time he was arrested, and the policeman he allegedly killed was killed by a pistol shot. There is nothing now to definitely link this man who has been taken into custody with the assassination of President Kennedy, who was killed by a bullet from a high-powered rifle. From all we can tell from reports from Robert McNeil at the hospital, from doctors who treated the president and were able to give specific and clinical details of the wound, indicating that it was a high-powered bullet, like probably a large-caliber bullet, too.
Now, we're focusing a lot on the media coverage, obviously, because it's our background, and this is how we experience this event in a way we couldn't have experienced any of the previous assassinations. And this was the first real flashbulb memory for the baby boomers, and a couple of generations before would have been the Titanic, and that was the first real telegraph disaster that people can watch. And as we said before, the Black Swan event, the thing that just comes out of nowhere and changes everything that happened. And by the way, the name was originally given because they thought that black swans couldn't possibly exist, and they do. So
interestingly, you mentioned that in the Titanic, and you're so right. By the time the I guess it was the Carpathia? Was that the rescue ship?
Yes.
I'm sure I'll get slaughtered for being wrong. But anyway.
White Star Line.
So by the time that ship arrived with survivors outside of 9 Broadway in Lower Manhattan, which is still some gore. If you walk around it, you'll see some beautiful stonework representing the White Star Line and shipping. There's a photo of the crowd that is assembled there. It's actually right near where that bronze bull is down there in Lower Manhattan, right where the Customs House, the Native American Museum, goes off in one direction. But right there, 9 Broadway, go look for it. That's where the White Star Line was. And go do a little Google, and you'll see the massive, massive crowd, because Telegraph allowed for people to know about this before the ship was in. And that had never happened before. It was really was a hinge moment in media. We should do a show on that, actually.
Yeah, it probably was also one reason why somebody asked us the other day on Twitter at Angry History why the Slocum is so little remembered, and the Slocum fire disaster that, of course, we did a podcast on, as opposed to the Titanic. And this is one of the reasons. I mean, reading about it in the paper just isn't the same as hearing it, and much less seeing it and seeing all the dead. And the reprinting back then, you didn't have color photos. And so, you know, that's one of the reasons. And those are the kind of people that we want to service and remember, I guess.
Absolutely. And they also, when they convened at the Waldorf Astoria in New York, Senate hearings almost immediately after the sinking of the Titanic. So you had witnesses very quickly being put on the record. So that helped cement the level of detail that we have about that disaster as well. But anyway, I don't want to get more than angry on this show. So let's move on.
So back to a time when TV was young and the world could follow wonderful events like a president involving in your city, as well as terrible events like him getting shot and murdered.
Yep. And after this, we have what comes as natural is the reaction. You know, it's we're familiar with so much of it. And even look at the film shot in Dealey Plaza that day, and the tears and people's just stunned disbelief. But we're going to start this off with some very interesting series of reactions from former President Eisenhower, the man who preceded President Kennedy in the White House. And I think, you know, there's so much uncertainty. Obviously, we've not been, Dean and I weren't alive when this happened. But you read up and you sort of recontextualize based on things like 9/11, mass events where you don't know if there's going to be another foot falling. Who knows what people were thinking when President Kennedy was killed? Was it the beginning of a coup? Was it, you know, was it the rest of the head of the government going to be chopped off? Uncertainty. So who do you bring out? You bring out, well, at least you get reaction from President Eisenhower. And anyway, go ahead, Dean. I think you have some interesting points on this.
Yeah, LBJ did fear that there could be a larger coup. And in fact, right now, that's standard operating procedure since then for the Secret Services. If there's any attempt on the president, they immediately grab the vice president. For instance, Vice President Cheney on 9/11, he said they grabbed him right away and hauled him out of his desk. And he said that his feet didn't even touch the floor, maybe like one step for every three or four of theirs. This is an important thing, too, because in the older times, previous times like Kennedy's time and such, the president could overrule them. And now they just really give them the control in the Secret Service, and they can tell you don't do things. Like if they want to tell President Clinton, sorry, no more receiving line, they'll tell him. And, you know, a president's going to respect that, you know.
I mean, LBJ was right there. I mean, he was there.
Yeah.
He could have been destroyed. There was actually early reports indicated that the vice president was wounded. You know, he was shot in the arm. Can you imagine doing that today? It would be so easy.
That's another thing that they don't do anymore either. They try not to have the president and vice president in the same place.
Right.
Certainly not the whole chain of command. As most of you probably know, there's a designate whenever there's a State of the Union or joint session of Congress where the whole chain of command is there. They have somebody who is in the line of the presidency. Maybe it's the Secretary of Agriculture. Or
think of it this way. It's Kirk, Spock, Scotty. Scotty's in the chair.
Well, they get way down. Like when you're talking to the Secretary of HUD, you know, you're like way down at what's his name, the male gigolo there in Starfleet, Kyle, Commander Kyle.
Oh yeah, Kyle, ah, good old Kyle. And Kyle, you know, he wanted to run that ship. He ran right into the ground.
Literally,
Synth the hall for him.
Wait, you're thinking of Riker? He's the only one who ran the Enterprise right into the ground, but.
That didn't. Then they ran into the water after that. But that's another show. Oh, man.
So, Eisenhower.
Yeah, so Eisenhower.
Here's the general's first reaction, and here he's being called on again by his nation, kind of, to sort of reassure these members of the press and through them, the American people.
Yep.
I share the sense of shock and dismay that the entire nation must feel at the despicable act that took the life of the nation's president. On the personal side, Mrs. Eisenhower and I share the grief that Mrs. Kennedy must now feel. And we send to her our prayerful thoughts and sympathetic sentiments in this hour.
General, how would you counsel the American people at this time?
In the face of such a terrible thing, I'm sure the entire citizenry of the nation will join as one man in expressing their, not only their grief, but their indignation at this act, and will stand faithfully behind the government.
Eisenhower, compared to a modern president, compared to a JFK, kind of adorable, you know, he's like kind of a grandfatherly figure. Like, to watch him try to talk on TV or watch him talk to a mic.
Yeah, we've talked about this before. Yeah. It's so true. He was la via vecchia, you know, he was the old way, the old school.
Well, even when he came out of the army, you know, he couldn't even dial a phone because he'd already had or always had secretaries to dial his phones for him and hook up to the exchange. And he'd never had a dial phone before because he had such long service to his country.
Yep.
All right, let's have another Eisenhower bite. Now, this one, he talks about the previous assassinations and gives his long perspective of it. And keep in mind, he would have been alive when McKinley was killed.
That's right.
Well, of course, in Lincoln's assassination, presidency went to a man who was a registered Democrat, Mr. Johnson. In Garfield, I doubt that there was any. And, of course, McKinley, that brought in Theodore Roosevelt. Of course, there have been other attempts in late years. Mr. Truman was at a grave threat to his life, and Mr. Roosevelt, just before he was inaugurated, you remember, down at when the mayor Cermak was killed, ran a very grave risk.
Should there be any concern, sir, over national security at a time like this?
No, I think the whole nation now would be almost all of it. Security agents.
Will the nation be all right in the few months ahead?
Oh, I'm not going to predict anything of that. I just say this. The American nation is a people of great common sense, and they are not going to be stampeded or bewildered.
Well, bewildered, maybe. You know, it's troubling and dark days. So the next logical question is, what does the world think? You know, what's the global take on this? You know, what do our enemies in the Soviet Union think? And here's a question as it was put to the general.
Could you say anything, General, about how people will feel abroad from all your experience with the United Nations and others? How will it be taken abroad?
Well, I think they will be a bit bewildered. This, in the civilized countries of the world, this doesn't happen so often. And you remember in the starting of World War I, the murder of the Archduke Ferdinand, I think his name was. Why, this itself almost was one of the contributory causes to that war. And but here, I just don't know what happens. And but we are a nation that where our freedoms are allowed or are observed in such a way that everybody is ready. Everybody is, you might say, capable of doing this if he's ready to put his own life on the line. These things have happened, and it seems inexplicable to me, because Americans are loyal. And it's just this occasional psychopathic sort of accident that occurs, and I don't know what we can do about it.
This was a prevailing attitude about America for a very long time. And when I'm listening to General Eisenhower here say, this doesn't happen in a democracy, it takes me right back again to McKinley and no less a radical anarchist than Alexander Berkman was in prison at the time. And he's writing to Emma Goldman, who Leon Czolgosz, who shot McKinley, said inspired him to do the act. And he said there was no obvious need to shoot McKinley. And people very much felt like that. Like, in a democracy, you can vote the guy out.
Right.
And even the anarchists were saying it at the time. They're saying, hey, this is, you know, this is not a czar. This is not, you know, I'm all for killing czars and kings and queens. But, you know, here you can vote him out, even though they were obviously against any form of government. It just, people really felt like who would want to shoot him. And, you know, we're all human beings. Maybe it makes you a little lax. You have a beloved president. McKinley was, they always said, the most beloved since Lincoln. His reelection numbers showed it. And JFK was, didn't have that level of love, certainly in the place that he was in. But still, the people that were around him, the Secret Service, you know, you think everything's kind of sunny. The guy just looked invincible. And
sure,
who knows, maybe that plays a part in some of these things.
I spend the rest of today and tomorrow.
I have canceled the dinner date that I had for tonight. Tomorrow, I'm going immediately to my home, and if I'm wanted for any purpose whatsoever, I will, of course, be available.
Would you have any advice for the American people at this time?
No, as I said, I know the American people will stand solid, and they will not be stampeded.
Thank you, Mr. President. All right.
Thank you. Good night, fellows.
You talk about McKinley and Kennedy, and then you have to talk about Shulgas versus Oswald. Shulgas was insane. I mean, isn't that the prevailing thought, that he was also nuts?
Well, Gateau was nuts. Gateau was, I mean, full on loopy, crazy, you know.
Right, goes make me ambassador to France.
Right, or I'm going to shoot you. Right. I mean, goes up to the gallows singing a poem that he wrote about going to join God, and blamed God for the killing, and then tried blaming the doctors. And if you've never seen Stephen Sondheim's Assassins, that's the best role. I mean, that's the one with the most meat in it.
Sure.
He was insane. Chogos was just an angry young man, and that became the profile.
Oh, yeah,
to use what we say afterwards.
Sure.
And there's a lot of parallels, actually, between him and Oswald, and just how disaffected he was. And he had a rough time with his father. Oswald had a rough time with his mother. He joined the Marines to get away from his mommy, which seems a little, he must really not have wanted to be with her.
Right.
And, you know, defecting to the Soviet Union and always looking for a place. And they were both very much looking for a place. And Oswald, of course, identified himself as a communist. I want to be a Marxist. I want to go to the Soviet Union. They kind of get bored of him over there, and then he comes back to America. After he shoots Kennedy, the Communist Party of the USA and the socialists say, we want nothing to do with him. I mean, he sent us...
He's not our guy.
Yeah, well, and it was the same thing with Chogosh, really. They said, you know, he wasn't one of our guys.
Right.
And it's, I always picture it sort of as the ED-209 in RoboCop, if you remember. You know,
please put down your weapon. You have 20 seconds to comply.
Tells him to put down the gun, and he does it, but then the robot's still trying to kill him, and everybody's pushing him away. And that's kind of what happens, you know.
This actually brings us to a great point about Oswald and who he was and being a communist. And this flies in the face of what a lot of the early thought was during the fog and the confusion right after the president was shot. Here, you've got a great thought about people reacting to this in New York City. Give a listen.
We go to NBC reporter Jeff Pond.
We're on the street outside the NBC studios in Rockefeller Center. Sir, how did you hear of the president's assassination?
Gentleman came into an office in which I was transacting business and mentioned it to us. And at the time, I really wasn't able to believe it. I had to hear it myself. And unfortunately, I did very shortly afterwards.
What is your feeling now?
I'm terribly shocked and saddened by it, and I would add angered by it.
Why angered?
I think it was a horrible, senseless thing, and I hope that the rest of the country feels the same way.
Do you think that this assassination somehow reflects a climate of opinion in the country now?
I hope that it doesn't reflect a climate of opinion that is very prevalent in the country today. It certainly, obviously, reflects an opinion that some people hold. I hope that, as an American, and the other people as Americans, do not generally hold this feeling.
You said some people. Who do you mean by that?
I don't feel expert enough to express an opinion, but the only evidence that I have as to who these people are these ultra-conservative groups that have been distributing literature and spreading hate in Texas, and who attacked Ambassador Stevenson about a week ago.
A little longer than that. Of course, no one knows that these people are indeed responsible.
No, certainly not.
Thank you, sir.
That's right at Rockefeller Center. I go to work there every day, and it looks the same, so it's always kind of jarring when you see this in video and you say, gosh, these people are so sure of the guy that did it. And we see it all the time in news. And that's why, especially for people who are in news, you've got to be really careful, because everybody's going to see what they want to see, because there's the boogeyman at the moment that's underneath the bed, and you're going to call it out and say, okay, it's got to be Al-Qaeda now, we say, right? Or right. It's got to, you know, grab the first person that you think is fleeing the scene. Or sometimes people say, oh, well, it might be someone, Bloomberg said it when they were that, they found that car full of explosives in Times Square. And he said, oh, it's got to be someone upset about the healthcare law. Or maybe somebody upset about the trans fats ban. Or, you know, or whatever is in your head, you know? I mean, they saw a video of a guy that was taking a sweater off, and they said, that must be him, you know? That's the guy. And it was just a guy who was hot, you know? So it's tough.
It is, but this thought about it being right-wing extremists, it didn't occur in a vacuum. There was a climate in Dallas, and Dallas has been maligned for a half a century because of this, but there was the John Birch Society down there. There was Adlai Stevenson just a couple of weeks before getting assaulted. Was he hit with a picket sign or something? LBJ and Lady Bird spat upon in 1960, you know, in the run-up to the election. So you sort of combine these popular stories of this sort of, I guess you can't call it unrest, but call it what do you call it?
Well, I guess the Germans call it Zeitgeist, right?
Which, exactly.
Hating myself for using that word right now.
But it's a good word.
It's true, because, you know, I worked with a fantastic man and a great veterinarian back when I was in veterinary medicine. He's since passed away. Mm-hmm. William J. O'Reilly. Unfortunately, he's since passed away. But I was very young just going into medicine and diagnosing things. And he said, you know, the old saying, and it was the first time I had heard it, that when I hear hoofbeats, I think of horses. I don't think of zebras. And I think that was the thing here. You said, well, gosh, these guys are handing out literature. They're saying all these angry, hateful things. They're, you know, and so it was natural that they would think that it had come from the right, because those are the people that were the loudest. But maybe that's partially the wisdom of the founding fathers. You let people speak and blow off steam and give them free speech. And then, you know, maybe they get it out of their system. That's what they actually said to JFK. Where there was an ad in the paper, and they said, we're exercising our right to petition you for grievances, you know, because you're the president and this is our right. And, you know, I think that is a lot of it. Political violence is pretty much unknown compared to the rest of the world in America as far as at this level. Mostly it's these disaffected guys who, you know, just decide to pick up a gun and they want to be big, you know.
Right.
Oswald wanted to be big. Czolgosz wanted to be big. Guiteau wanted to be ambassador to France. He had this great inflated sense of himself that he thought he had won Garfield the election. I mean, he was unbalanced, but still, it draws them, you know. Of course, Booth wanted to save the South and had all these notions, you know, that he was going to. And I think that's what draws it, and that's why, you know, you can have someone as different as Dwight David Eisenhower and Alexander Berkman both say, what's the point of killing an American president?
Right.
It's a line in the movie Suddenly with Frank Sinatra.
All this loot and they don't even know what they're doing. A half a million clams for absolutely nothing. Because tonight at 5 o'clock, I kill the president. 1 second after five, there's a new president. What changes? Nothing. What are they paying for? Nothing.
Oswald also shot a general. Always reminds me of the general out of Dr. Strangelove, Edwin Walker. He shot him. He was very active in the John Birch Society. He was actually relieved of command in Western Germany at the time, West Germany, because he was pushing for all this segregationist stuff, and he was just really pushing that point of view, a right-wing guy at the time, and Oswald shot him too. Oswald just was anti-authoritarian, this only woman who knew both JFK. She worked in the Senate staff and interviewed Oswald, Priscilla Johnson McMillan.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah, really an amazing story. She's still alive. She's 85. Mm-hmm. And she wrote a book with Oswald's wife after the assassination, and her husband was dead. And she said he's anti-authoritarian, called himself a Marxist. And, you know, she was working for the Progressive magazine over there in the USSR at the time. So she's certainly not a right-wing person herself.
Right.
And she explains, you know, he was carrying a Rosenberg leaflet around with him. He was really, you know, he just wanted to be part of that. He wanted to be part of.
This is Julius and Ethel Rosenberg we're talking about, who were executed for spying for the Soviet Union. Americans executed for spying for the Soviets. Sorry, go ahead.
No, that's all right. You're right. Tell people. Yeah. But it's, you know, he was just wanted to be part of all that anti. And then he gets to the USSR. He doesn't fit in any better than he fit in the U.S. It was something inside of him. And I think he thought he could, you know, go after JFK and he would then be a hero by doing that. And of course, it didn't work out that way. It didn't work out that way for Booth either. But at least Booth lived long enough to see all the newspapers cursing what he'd done.
Right. Well, everyone's got an axe to grind, that's for sure. And the ones who have pulled it off, how many times, how many presidents have we lost through the years?
Four.
Martyred four, right? So Lincoln, Garfield, McKinley, and Kennedy.
Before we said that there were people who were still alive then that would have remembered the assassination of McKinley, and now we're seeing JFK's assassination. One person who knew McKinley and was close friends with JFK was Alice Lee Roosevelt, Alice Roosevelt Longworth, President yep. Theodore Roosevelt's daughter. Yep. And she was there. She commented, and speaking of some of the reaction that people had to the assassination, I mean, when she found out her father was president, she was very happy. And after JFK got assassinated, she said, I look back now and I say, it was terrible that I was dancing. That I was like, oh, cool, he's president. And, you know, she wasn't that young either. She's, right. You know, she's 17. She's old enough to know better. She had a great relationship with JFK, and more strained with RFK, because RFK would always get so worked up about her teasing him, and she just loved that. That was like red meat to her. So,
yeah.
But there was just this thing. If you were close to a person like that, or a person in the public eye, you kind of walked with this all the time, and mm-hmm. that made us want to replay this soundbite that we played of Martin Luther King. And this is after JFK has been assassinated, and they say to him, you know, you're top target for a lot of people out there. And so let's hear what Dr. King said about how he walked under this dark cloud that he felt.
Okay.
You have had attempts made on your life and have been threatened perhaps even tonight. What is it like to walk under this constant threat?
Well, it's often difficult, but when you live with it so long, you almost become immune to being afraid as a result of these threats. I guess you have to come to the point of looking at these things philosophically, and this is where I have decided to stand. I believe firmly that this cause is right, and that someone must have the courage and the fortitude to stand up for it, even if it means suffering or even if it means death. And I have always felt that unmerited suffering is redemptive, and even if I have to die for this cause, if physical death is the price that others have to pay, then it is a price that is paid to free the soul of our nation and to free our children from a permanent spiritual death. And in this sense, I think it is very redemptive, or it can be, even if it occurs.
Thank you, Dr. King.
And Dr. King carried that grace with him to the grave less than 5 years later. I wanted to get to one last bit of reaction, and this is one that you may have heard a lot of in this anniversary or coverage commemorating this. This was during a Boston Symphony concert. The only reason it was recorded is it was being played on a whole bunch of different stations, so someone caught it. And this is conductor Eric Leinsdorf telling the crowd what was almost a certainty at that point. You will listen.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a press report over the wires. We hope that it is unconfirmed, but we have to doubt it, that the President of the United States has been the victim of an assassination. We will play the funeral march from Beethoven's Third Symphony.
Just the crowd reacting in unison is always, oh, it just gets me. It's just you talk about what a terrible day. There's one way you can just hear it, and it sticks with me. Let's move along to one of these things for years, and again, this is something else that the Book of Lists had, you know, is one of these great things. All the lists of crazy coincidences between the Lincoln assassination and the Kennedy assassination. And then what was it, Dean? It's like Lincoln had a secretary named Kennedy, and Kennedy had a secretary named Lincoln. And, you know, Lincoln was shot in a theater, and his shooter, you know, escaped to a warehouse, and Kennedy was shot from a warehouse and his killer escaped to the theater, although that's true.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of these sort of similarities. Lincoln did not have a secretary named Kennedy,
right,
by the way. But, you know, there's a lot of these coincidences, and we'll put a link at angryhistory.com. We always put links of all the stuff that we talk about.
Mm-hmm.
You could see these kind of debunked, or you can just Google them right now on Snopes or somewhere like that and see a lot of these coincidences, Johnson being the second most popular name. Not too shocking that both had vice presidents named Johnson.
Yep.
Back in 1992, the Skeptical Inquirer held a contest, a spooky presidential coincidences contest.
Oh boy.
Because Ann Landers had reprinted this Lincoln-Kennedy list for the zillionth time, they said. And so they wanted to sort of
add... Chilling parallels. Not just parallels, mind you. Chilling parallels.
Yes chilling. Yes. Because the name Johnson is very chilling.
Yes.
But the idea was readers would come up with their own lists. And I thought this was a great way to kind of involve people. And one of the two winners was Arturo Magadan of Mexico City. He came up with 16 stunning coincidences between President Kennedy and former Mexican president Alvaro Obregón.
Of course.
So that list of Lincoln things, a lot of them are just coincidences. And again, this was part of the legacy. It's Jackie Kennedy was a young woman then. She wanted mm-hmm. to promote her husband's legacy. Actually, Lucretia Garfield was the same way with her husband. Unfortunately, Ida McKinley was very sickly. She couldn't promote his legacy. They didn't have any surviving children. And unfortunately, we all know the story of Mary Todd Lincoln, that she was, you know, had a lot of mental problems.
Yeah.
She had to be committed by her son. She was not
utterly broken.
Yeah.
No. It's interesting, this whole, you know, why do we come up with these lists? And I think a lot of it has to do with this quest for understanding, something that is very, very hard to comprehend. And, you know, that's what tends to happen. But, of course, now we live in a BuzzFeed universe where there's lists for everything. Because, hey, you may as well have a list if you're, you know, you can't have your attention held long enough to actually read something.
And ideally on as many pages to click through as possible so they get lots of click
yeah,
views.
Exactly.
Yeah. Like, give it to me on one page, and don't give me a page with a video on it, because I'm not going to sit there and watch it always.
And those GIFs that they put together, I hate that. It just drives me nuts. So anyway, but what are you going to do? One thing we haven't spent a lot of time with on this podcast, because, yeah, you know what? If you want that, you can go somewhere else. You start getting into guessing games, and, you know, the whole thing turns into an episode of In Search Of. But it's conspiracy theories, of which there are plenty. We live in, like we've said in a previous podcast, you know, we are living, because of the internet, in conspiracy theory heaven or hell. But I think probably the biggest one, well, maybe 9/11 rivals that now, but the Kennedy assassination, fodder for conspiracy theorists. Well, conspiriologists, was that one of the words we learned?
Oh, yeah, in a news story. I was like, wow, that sounds so official, you idiots. Doesn't mean anything. I wish I could remember the news source so I could shame them to you nice people, but I can't recall what it was. But yeah, in April 2013, the AP-GFK survey found 59% of Americans say it was a conspiracy. But the good news from our perspective is it's down from the 2003 Gallup poll, which found a full 75%, three-quarters of Americans believed that it was a conspiracy. And the April poll of this year found 24% think Oswald acted alone. And that's the highest percentage for the lone gunman theory since just after his assassination. And it's interesting that there's a story also that we'll link at angryhistory.com where LBJ said there's still questions about Lincoln's assassination. And damn it, I'm not going to let there be any question here about JFK. And of course, we know he did not succeed in tamping of that.
Not one little bit.
And the Soviets did their job, too. You know, they pushed the sort of these conspiracy theories, too. They wanted us
wondering
who had done it and what had happened. And one bit of fodder there, which is not too off now, is in 1992, President Bush 41 signed the Assassination Records Collection Act. And that requires all remaining documents about the Kennedy assassination to be released October 26, 2017. Yep. So join us then.
Exactly. As we move through the redactions, we'll be reading every fifth word.
So. Yeah.
It's funny. This sort of spins us to something I wanted to hit on before we start to wrap this show up. We're recording this on November 26th, 2013. And on the 25th, 20th Century Fox released a sort of a viral clip for the upcoming X-Men movie that ties the Kennedy assassination in with one of the villains, Magneto, in there. You know what? Ordinarily, I love stuff like this where you sort of you can pull together things from reality and sort of prop up your fiction with it. But what were they thinking? I mean, why give a listen. Why release something like this so close to the 50th anniversary?
On November 22nd, 1963, President John Kennedy was critically wounded. Shortly after the events in Dealey Plaza, in a secret trial, Eric Lenscher was found guilty of first-degree murder and conspiracy to assassinate the President of the United States. However, the evidence against the mutant called Magneto remains circumstantial. An amateur photograph of Lenscher on the grassy knoll and the rounds fired from a rifle. According to a recently declassified report from the Warren Commission, Lenscher altered the trajectory of Oswald's second bullet, effectively murdering the president. But even half a century after the assassination, the events of November 22nd continue to be the source of controversy. Why would Eric Lenscher murder the president? How was the gunman Lee Harvey Oswald involved? And what hard evidence is there to confirm that Magneto manipulated the infamous bent bullet? Find out more at thebentbullet.com.
Again, fun and cool, and you know what? In that first, the most recent X-Men film, they had the mutants involved in the Cuban Missile Crisis. It's just, I don't know, your timing sucks, 20th Century Fox. Crappy. I'm sure some moron who doesn't even remember what it was sitting there going, oh, this will be great because it's right. It's pegged to the anniversary. So, yeah. F you.
Admittedly, we are extremely cynical, but, you know, there's one thing, last thing before we leave you nice people. I think we have one more point to make, and that's about Jackie Kennedy stepping off the plane with her brother-in-law.
Yeah, this has stuck with me for so long. And, you know, that whole day, obviously, you know, she didn't want to leave the president's body. And it's this quote attributed to Lady Bird Johnson in her audio diary where we saw Jackie Kennedy coming off the plane later that day with her brother-in-law, Bobby Kennedy. Her legs were still stained with the president's blood. Her suit was still stained with the president's blood. Of course, she could have cleaned herself up. She could have changed. She chose not to. And according to Lady Bird Johnson, Mrs. Kennedy said, quote, "I want them to see what they have done to Jack," end quote. Powerful statement from grieving woman and our grieving first lady.
And she was the one who gave us Camelot. She wanted him to be remembered because it was a poem that he liked. And that was, you know, that was not while he was alive, this notion of Camelot. This was really her going into overdrive to preserve his memory, or part of her effort to preserve his memory is, you know, anybody would who lost a husband tragically sitting right next to him. But she also had memorized a poem that he liked, his favorite poem, and it's called A Rendezvous with Death. I Have a Rendezvous with Death. And he would ask her to recite this poem to him.
Mm.
And, you know, you think about that afterwards and you say, gosh, fatalistic. And it just had to really have stuck with her. I'm glad that she chose the other poem, but it's the Rendezvous with Death poem, obviously, that sort of also brackets his life, because he did have a rendezvous with death on that road just before that underpass in Dallas.
Yep, he sure did. You know, we Dean and I, just among ourselves, and we mentioned it a little bit in the Gettysburg podcast, but we think about alternate history a lot as a tool, and it's something that's fascinating for the what-if factor.
And we talked a minute ago, we gave a little critique there of the X-Men, the way that they used Kennedy. And so we wanted to give you a good piece of fiction, or a piece we like. You know, we're going to go see the X-Men movie, let's be honest. That just
absolutely.
That was just a little bad taste in our mouth there. But there's
Just for the timing. You know, like Watchmen did it, they had the comedian be the guy who killed Kennedy. The X-Men had the cigarette-smoking man as the guy who killed Kennedy. It was just bad, crappy, intentional timing, in my opinion.
Yeah, you just see the strings. And you know, you're very cynical. You see them in that meeting saying, oh, that'd be the perfect time to release it, and it just strikes us the wrong way because we've been in those meetings and, you know, stinks. But this is called The Winterberry by Nicholas A. DiCiario, and we have a little reading here of it to kind of give you a flavor of the theory or the theme or the plot behind this particular short story.
May 1971. It was Uncle Teddy who taught me how to read and write. I think it took a long time, but I'm not sure. I heard him arguing with Mother about it one night a few years ago when I wasn't supposed to be out of my room. But I was very excited, with the next day being my birthday, and I couldn't sleep. "He can do it," Uncle Teddy had said. And Mother said, "He doesn't care whether he reads or writes. It's you who cares. Why do you torture yourself? Let him be." "He's 54 years old," Uncle Teddy said. "Let him be." Mother sounded very angry. I listened to Uncle Teddy walk across the room. "If you feel that way," he said, "why didn't you just let him die?" There was a long silence before Mother said, "I don't know. and another long silence after that. Something in their voices frightened me, so I returned to my room. I became very ill, and for several weeks, Dr. Armbruster came to see me every day. But he wouldn't let anyone else come in, because he said I was too weak to have visitors, when I was much better.
So that's the Winterberry, a little taste of it there. If you have a chance, actually, we could probably link to it. It's an old short story. Link to it at angryhistory.com if we can find it, or an anthology that it's in. But it's a very interesting story, and obviously
it's very short, very sad.
Yeah.
For what it suggests, you know.
Yeah, it is. And if you haven't, please go and pick it up.
Yep. Well, thank you so much for tuning in to our take on JFK 50 years later.
This was a marathon session, obviously. We hope you enjoyed it. We had a lot of audio here we want to share with you, and we hope that it was unique, at least some stuff you hadn't heard before about this assassination and others. You know, there's not a lot of stock put in history, so maybe this helps put it in perspective a little bit for you with the past assassinations. I mean, a lot of people don't even realize that we did lose presidents other than Kennedy and Lincoln, and what the assassins were like. They're not just these people that jump out of history. They had a life. They had things that drove them to this. Unfortunately, Oswald was extremely troubled, and he did this, and it's a terrible thing, and we'll never be the same after it, but we can at least try to remember the facts of what happened, and, you know, I think work at it that way.
Yeah, and we're going to leave you with one more bit of audio from the late, great David Brinkley, who wraps up Terrible Day in a very, very appropriate way. My name's Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Karyanis.
We'll see you next time. Thank you.
We're about to wind this up for tonight, because about all that could happen on one day has. For some final reflection on one of the more horrible days in American history, you find there is a great deal that could be said about the political and other changes we can look forward to now, but I think it would be bad taste to go into that now, and I won't. It has all been shocking, but perhaps one element in the shock was the speed. By the Washington clock, at a little after 1 o'clock this afternoon, President Kennedy was about as alive as any human being ever gets. Young, strong, vigorous, looking forward to, no doubt, 5 more years, he hoped, of leadership in this country and of the Western world. His wife, young, beautiful, looking very happy, was beside him and seeming to be having a wonderful time, and leaning across the back seat of the car to say to him, "You can't say Dallas hasn't been friendly to you." That was a little after 1 o'clock. 5 hours later, at 6 o'clock, Mr. Kennedy had been murdered. Lyndon Johnson was president of the United States. Mrs. Kennedy was a widow, a brave and composed one that nobody could fail to admire. All of them were back in Washington, returning in the same airplane that took them to Texas to an incredible tragedy. And the sheer speed of it was just too fast for the senses. Roosevelt, dead of a stroke, came back here from Warm Springs, Georgia, in a train, sides of it draped in black crepe. It steamed majestically across the southern landscape toward Washington, taking a little time about it and giving everybody a time to think a bit about what had happened. But not today. There is seldom any time to think anymore, and today there was none. In about 4 hours, we had gone from President Kennedy in Dallas alive to back in Washington dead, and a new president in his place. There is no more news here tonight, and really no more to say, except that what has happened today has been just too much, too ugly, and too fast.
Visit angryhistory.com to learn more about the topics discussed on today's episode and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You can also like us on Facebook, tweet us at Angry History, or use the email address angry@angryhistory.com.